The minimum wage in Ohio in January increases to $8.70 per hour. That's $1.45 an hour better than the federal minimum. The increase will put Ohio somewhere in the middle of the pack, with 23 states mandating higher minimum wage levels, including six plus the District of Columbia that are phasing in a $15 minimum. 20 others either have matching or default to the lower federal minimum of $7.25. Two states have no minimum wage. But even with the increase, in Ohio, a person working 40 hours a week for a year would generate just a little over $18,000. That's less than the federal poverty line for a family of three. Coming up, the role of minimum wage in the American economy and the disconnect with what it takes to make a living. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include iDrive, maker of Remote PC, providing real-time remote access to computers anywhere, and featuring Remote PC Vision, an augmented reality support tool. Learn more at remotepc.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The minimum wage in Ohio in January increases to $8.70 per hour. That's for non-tipped workers. Six states plus the District of Columbia are phasing in a $15 an hour minimum. So that puts Ohio somewhere in the middle of the rest of the pack, with 23 states mandating higher minimum wage levels and 20 others either matching what Ohio has or defaulting to the lower federal minimum of $7.25. Even with the increase, a person working 40 hours a week for a year generates an annual income of just over $18,000, and that's below the federal poverty line for a family of three or more. So there's no way anyone's really suggesting this is a living wage. So we're talking about the meaning of a living wage and the gap between that and the minimum wage in the United States, what the research tells us about what works, what doesn't, where, and so forth. Ray Hederman is the executive director of the Economic Research Center and vice president of policy at the Buckeye Institute. That's a conservative research and educational institute here in Columbus. He studies and writes about the economy, labor markets, and tax systems. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
What kind of, when we talk about studying minimum wage and the impact of minimum wage, what do those studies look like? What do they mean?
Sure. You know, there's a variety of research that's been done on this topic. The Congressional Budget Office this summer just published a big survey because it's a good way for economists to have full employment, being able to study cities that have increased the minimum wage in states. And so a lot of times they'll look at it basically before and after. You know, here's a state or city that just increases the minimum wage, and let's look at employment. What are the employment effects after the minimum wage went up? And they try to look at different areas, different businesses. Is the restaurant industry more adversely affected than maybe, you know, the white-collar industry? What's the impact on minorities and teenagers? And, you know, the evidence is very mixed. You've heard probably in the last 20 years, a lot of people are saying our traditional thinking on the minimum wage as a huge hit to jobs has been overstated. The Congressional Budget Office, the survey still said, though, that the bulk of the findings indicate that the minimum wage will impact jobs, but maybe not to the extent that we thought 30 years ago.
There's the pros outweigh the cons, or at least they are. It's a wash at the very least.
Well, you know, it depends on kind of who you are, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are definitely some workers that will receive an increase for the minimum wage. My concern with increasing the minimum wage is that you're denying opportunities for some people. You know, when the Congressional Budget Office, you know, said what is their best guess of what would happen with a $15 minimum wage, they said there'd be about 17 million people that have an increase, but about 1.3 million lost jobs, with the bulk of those jobs occurring to teenagers. And, you know, teenagers are about a third of all earners of the minimum wage. You know, most minimum wage, about half, are under the age of 25. And so this is kind of the entry-level jobs, you know, summer jobs, you know, bringing somebody in to clerk, lifeguard, you know, learning how to get their experience and learning those valuable skills. And the question and the problem is those are the people that are going to be most adversely affected by increasing the minimum wage, at least in the short term.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're spending the hour talking about minimum wage, what it means, how it compares and contrasts what we think of as a living wage. we're doing that because minimum wage in Ohio in January increases to $8.70 per hour. My guest right now, Ray Hederman, he is the executive director of the Economic Research Center and vice president of policy at the Buckeye Institute. If you have a question or comment coming up later in the hour, we'd be glad to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Ray, you said that, and correct me if I'm wrong, of course, that during an economy like the one we're living through now with historically low unemployment, it's a good time to study it?
Well, you know, it's irrelevant whether or not it's a good time to study it. People are increasing the minimum wage and they're not seeing bad effects. In some ways, it's a bad time to study because the economy is so strong and a lot of people are finding entry-level jobs higher than minimum wage.
I mean, there's a lot of competition for labor.
Exactly. Right. You know, especially, you know, we've seen an all-time high in job openings to job availabilities. And so as a result, you know, you're seeing bonuses being paid out by fast food restaurants, you know, jobs that traditionally have been seen has entry level, you know, working the cashier at McDonald's, you know, is paying higher than minimum wage in a lot of areas.
We call them entry level jobs, and I get what you're saying by that. But the fact is, the way the job market is today, a lot of people, that is their living. That isn't entry level for them. That's how they're making a living. They're working two or three jobs like that. Right?
Well, some people and everything. That's absolutely
true. It's
not
that versus a factory job or that versus an executive ladder.
Right. So, you know, the employment has changed. And so the idea that as we've moved away from the manufacturing, right, you don't have people that sit there and they go work at they don't go work at GM for 40 years, right, and then retire.
Right.
And so, you know, people are moved from job to job, job to job. The reason we call them entry-level jobs is that, you know, they don't pay sustainability, you know, to be able to support yourself over a lifetime. And that's why the people primarily on them are younger people. And the idea is they start learning skills that then they can go up, become a shift manager, go to manager, take the experience that they have. Because one of the most important ways for people to be able to get higher wages is to accumulate work experience. You can go in and say, you know what, I spent 6 months, you know, working a cash register, twirling a sign, showed up on time, know the value of being respectful, you know, being professional, being courteous to customers, and then they get a better job. And so, you know, you take a look, and that's why we say they get jobs, then they get raises, and then they go on to better employment. And that's really what we're looking for.
So the minimum wage, when it was established, I imagine the first one was sometime after the Depression, sometime during the New Deal. Am I right?
Yeah.
What was the thought about that? Was never intended to be a living wage or not?
No, you know, the idea was, you know, as part of the great reforms, you know, that people are interested in saying, let's clean up kind of the labor market, you know, take a look and making sure that we have laws preventing child labor laws, you know, start looking at kind of worker safety. And some of the ideas was, you know, establishing a minimum wage. The idea that people would not be enthralled to kind of the company store idea. And then states have basically put different tweaks on it. As you said, you know, about half the states now defer to the federal minimum, and many more basically have enacted state-level minimum wages, some indexed to inflation like Ohio. But one of the new phenomenons we're seeing is, you know, affluent cities creating their own higher minimum wage than the states, with the idea being, I think, that because the economy is so hot, you know, now's a good time to kind of prop up the labor market. And there's a lot of studies coming out right now was what's the impact on San Francisco, Seattle, you know, Portland that have really increased their minimum wage laws.
And what does the impact of having it be city-driven in that way have on the rest of the country?
Yeah, so part of it is it's a great case study for economists to look at kind of what's happening on the cities. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of it is that you're saying, are there going to be dislocation effects where businesses are locating outside the city? Maybe restaurants are moving from Seattle, you know, over across the river out to some of the islands. You know, taking a look and saying, what does this mean? One of the big studies that people are going to be looking at is the state of Oregon, where they basically created a higher minimum wage for Portland and then lower minimum wage the farther east you went from Portland to the more rural areas. And again, you know, this is recognition of the fact that higher minimum wage, you know, can have severe disemployment effects, can really discourage business entry because businesses sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to invest in capital. And what that means in non-economist terms, if, you know, you go to the grocery stores, you're seeing a lot more of self-checkout lines and you're seeing fewer checkers. You go to a fast food restaurant, you're going to start seeing kiosks, you know, where you do punch button ordering, fewer people behind the counter. And so what that means is, as the minimum wage goes up, you're going to see businesses starting to rely more on machinery, technology to replace higher cost human labor.
As far as startups and new businesses, smaller businesses, it doesn't affect them, right?
So some of the minimum wage basically depends on, the law. So some of them, like, for example, for Ohio, I think it's $300,000. I think, if you have below 300,000 gross receipts, you're still paying the lower level minimum wage. It varies on locality. But the idea is that these mandates disproportionately impact, small businesses and startups.
But how do they do that if they're exempt largely?
So the idea, that's why they're exempt, Anne, is basically, let's try to make them exempt and everything. But there is some research saying that, a lot of businesses start because they want to grow. And so, so you're taking a look at some of the startups, research is coming out saying some of these startups are more likely to invest more in capital as compared to investing more in workers. So, for example, if you're a small business, you know that you're going to hit the limit where you're now be considered a large business. Mm-hmm. You might say, instead of hiring a person, two people, I'm going to hire a computer kiosk to take orders, or maybe I'm going to invest more in a burger flipper machine, an automated pizza maker. That's what economists mean, saying that some of these small businesses are going to invest more in capital than some of the labor.
And then the large corporations that are, there's an issue here between the large gap between the least among us when it comes to economics and the 1%.
Yeah. So the large businesses and everything in some ways are more easily able to afford minimum wage. I mean,
right.
So some of them have actually advocated before because they knew it blocked out kind of competition. And so I think, the ideas that you're really getting at is, what's the best way to help boost prosperity and income for families, for workers? And I really think kind of minimum wage is a second or third best. That's why I kind of look at the earned income tax credit, kind of a work subsidy, which basically says, let's help people, give them a subsidy from the government, basically, to encourage them to work more, to help them make more money, but not at the same point providing a big disincentive to businesses. I think that's a more efficient policy, though it's enacted by the federal government. Some states have looked at that as compared to the minimum wage.
I know that now, because of the way the economy is right now, the likes of Costco and Walmart and all of those companies, the big super chains, big box stores are competing with each other, mm-hmm. and they're paying better wages. But there's also the storyline and the narrative about how the taxpayers are supporting the companies because they pay the people, or in the past, at least not right now. Mm-hmm. So point taken that it's not necessarily a good time to look at these things, but that they're paying such low wages that the taxpayers are paying for food stamps, they're paying for, they're picking up the slack for them because they don't make enough money working 40 hours a week. Subsidizing, it's considered a form of corporate welfare in a way. Some people see it that way.
I would basically see it the other way, that basically it's kind of subsidizing the individual. And because a lot of those programs are means tested, which means the more money you make, the less you receive from government, mm-hmm. it's actually a disincentive. And that's kind of what the Congressional Budget Office had kind of used, and a lot of the economists look at these, saying, particularly Medicaid, for example, if you make too much money, you lose your Medicaid benefit. So as a result, a lot of people would work, part time enough that they can get as much wage income as they can, and then they'd still get their Medicaid benefit. And this is a rational decision people are making to maximize their income, making sure they get the health insurance they need. So you take a look at kind of, what's going on with some of the minimum wage research. And I think, that's why you're saying there are winners, but there are the losers. And so, I'm concerned about, are we setting up a scenario where a lot of young people, the Congressional Budget Office found about over 500,000 teenagers would no longer be employed. And, that's a big problem because these are people we need to figure out ways to be able to train, get them skills. And so I think another option we could look at would be better education programs, aimed at people like the teenagers that want to be working, making sure they have resources that they need to be able to go into like welding jobs, different types of skilled trades, instead of kind of our one size fits all college, which may not be effective for the modern workplace.
We're talking about, well, inspired by, talking about a lot of things right now, inspired by the news that the minimum wage in Ohio increases to $8.70 per hour in January. My guest is Ray Hederman. He's Executive Director of the Economic Research Center and Vice President of the Policy at the Buckeye, Institute. Coming up, we're going to hear from the liberal think tank Policy Matters Ohio, what they think. And coming up a little bit later, we're going to also hear from Columbus City Council member Elizabeth Brown. She led the charge for a $15 per hour minimum wage for city workers. Tell us what you think, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The minimum wage in Ohio increases to $8.70 per hour in January. Six states plus the District of Columbia are phasing in a $15 an hour minimum, and all of that puts Ohio somewhere in the middle of the pack, with 23 states mandating higher minimum wage levels and 20 others either matching what Ohio has or defaulting to the lower federal minimum of $7.25. Throwing around a lot of numbers right now, the bottom line is that even with the increase, a person working 40 hours a week for a year generates an annual income of just over $18,000. That's below the federal poverty line for a family of three or more. It's probably someone's hard-pressed to support themselves, let alone a family of three with that. We're talking about the value of a minimum wage, what needs to happen for a full-time job to generate a living wage. Still with us is Ray Hederman. He's Executive Director of the Economic Research Center at the Buckeye Institute. He writes about such things and studies them. Michael Shields studies minimum wage as well, overtime and workers' compensation issues for the liberal think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He joins us. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks, Dan. Glad to be here.
You know, what do you think? You know, you hear about the minimum wage going up. It's not that much. What is it, 15 or 20 cents an hour? Maybe when you add that up, that's an extra what? I mean, maybe 80 bucks a week, maybe? Or is my math all wrong? What does it matter to you from where you sit, Michael Shields, that the minimum wage is going up?
Sure. So the minimum wage is actually adjusting because of the inflation index that Ohio voters passed. It's actually a really smart policy back in 2006 when we raised the minimum wage by ballot initiative. So basically what this does is keeps the minimum wage on an even keel with rising prices. It's indexed to the inflation rate. So it acts as a kind of a safeguard. It's not really pushing wages up in terms of purchasing power. Now, it is a really important safeguard. We didn't have this before 2006, and because of that, the minimum wage from its highest level, which was way back in 1968, has actually fallen in Ohio by about 28%. If we had kept pace with inflation just from that year, workers would be making just over $12 an hour in Ohio today. So Ohio's minimum wage workers lost a big chunk of their earnings. Because we neglected the wage with inflation. This policy fixes that going forward, but it doesn't restore the losses. We should be passing a living minimum wage policy.
Ray Hederman, the idea of having a minimum wage, if you're going to have it, index it to inflation at least. Do you, What do you think about that?
Sure. You know, the advantage of that is that it provides certainty to businesses. You know, they're able to take a look at what their labor costs are, exactly what they complain. But it's interesting because some research actually suggests that that's not as advantageous. So there's some research that came out in 2018 that looked at states that have an indexed inflation versus states that have a nominal wage, a minimum wage, which means that it does degrade over time. And they found that the disemployment effects, like the lost job opportunities for states that index minimum wages, were three times as high. So, you know, the trade-off is that it makes continues to make labor more costly to businesses, but businesses can plan for it. And part of that planning, unfortunately, may be businesses saying, you know what, labor prices can continue to high. I'm going to invest now in a piece of machinery that makes it more affordable.
Michael Shields, how do you respond to that? I mean, partly some people say, well, people are investing in machines to replace people anyways now. Would it matter?
Sure.
Does the minimum wage affect that?
Well, and there was a lot said right there. But just to start with, you know, how do you compete with machines? I think the simple answer is you don't. You know, you use machines to supplement the work that workers are doing. And we all sort of understand the life cycle of electronics. You know, they're introduced as new technologies and they're very expensive. Very quickly, those costs start to collapse. The reality is we simply cannot have the cost of a computer be the basis for determining our wage policy. And as a matter of fact, computer used to be a job title. And NASA used quite a lot of them.
Right.
The fact that automation makes certain jobs obsolete is a reason that we should be investing in training. It is a reason that we need to have really robust unemployment insurance programs so that people have the opportunity to take advantage of training programs. But, you know, the notion that we could set wages to be competitive with, you know, the price of a computer, for instance, it's simply not practical. It doesn't make sense.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about minimum wage today, what it means in relationship to the cost of living. You just heard from Michael Shields. He is from the think tank Policy Matters Ohio, and also with us, Ray Hederman. He is from the think tank The Buckeye Institute. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael Shields, what are your expectations about what a minimum wage should achieve? I mean, it's not much, so why have it?
Well, it's a pretty simple standard. Everybody who works full-time should earn enough to cover the basics. That's pretty straightforward, I think. You know, the highest minimum wage that we have had on record was worth more than $12 an hour in today's terms. Because of policy neglect for many decades before voters stepped in to change it, the real value of the minimum wage fell. It's fallen by 28% in Ohio. And look, we know we've had a $12 minimum wage before. It should be uncontroversial that our minimum wage should meet or exceed that threshold again today. The fact that it doesn't means that today's minimum wage workers have fewer wage protections, have a lower wage standard than their grandparents had half a century ago. But I want to also just, you know, take that further and say, you know, while our history certainly matters and we should recognize that this is where we have been, the economy has also grown really substantially since then. The cost of the level of the minimum wage should reflect the cost of living. But since our highest minimum wage on record, the Ohio economy has grown 88%. Workers last year produced 88% more than they did back in 1968. Not only have low-wage workers shared none of that growth, they're in fact down 28%. We need to correct that.
Ray Hederman, do you dispute that notion that the economy has grown that much? It has, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, the economy's much bigger, you know, but to compare the Ohio economy today to the manufacturing-based economy of the 60s, I think ignores reality. I mean, Ohio has been one of the lowest job-producing states in the country. We were one of the last states to come out of the Great Recession. And unfortunately, you know, our economy is not nearly as strong or competitive as it was in 1968. And I think, you know, we need to recognize that fact and figure out what are policies to that can produce better qualified workers that can compete with countries around the world. And one thing I think Michael's absolutely right on is, you know, the importance of job training programs, figuring out ways to develop better educated high school graduates to give them better careers.
Yeah. So we're talking about such different jobs, too. We're not talking about, you know, somebody working, cleaning, you know, picking up waste baskets and stuff at a machine shop that they're eventually going to be able to learn, you know, machining in, Michael Shields, right? We're talking about service industry stuff at this point.
Well, a lot of the jobs that are that dominate most of our labor market are, in fact, in the service sector. You know, so to suggest that those are threatened by outside trade, I think, you know, we would want to be careful about that. But just to be really clear, you know, I'm not talking about how the global economy has grown or how Ohio is, you know, competing with nations that are developing. I mean, of course, you know, we've seen a lot of developing nations lifted up out of poverty in the last several decades. That's great. I'm actually talking about the growth that we see right here that Ohio workers produce. Last year, again, that was 88% more than what they did in 1968. So to say the economy is different, well, of course it's different. We're far wealthier, and we're wealthier because workers are, in fact, more educated. I agree that we want to invest in strong training programs, but it's also true that Ohio's workers are more educated than they have ever been before, and they're more productive than they've ever been before. The breakdown here isn't, you know, workers need to somehow get more skilled in order to earn a higher living. You know, that comports with our values. Mm-hmm. A rising tide lifts all boats. We, you know, we say that because we think it should be true. We have to back that up with policy. Workers are more productive today than ever before. They don't have the bargaining power to capture their share in earnings for what they're producing for their employers.
Right.
Yep. So very quickly, I think that, yes, Ohio's economy is bigger. But, you know, our productivity measures in terms of productivity has a measure of the economy. Like, are you producing more for output for inputs has been relatively slow. It hasn't been as strong as we've seen.
Again, it's the type of job people are.
Exactly. You know, and the shifting to services. And so, again, the idea is what's the most efficient way to reward workers fairly, you know, for those service type jobs.
And what do you think?
You know, and I think basically, as I mentioned, you know, taking a look at some wage subsidies like the earned income tax credit superior to the minimum wage, being able to give, you know, job training programs to give the better skilled, because my concern is, you know, we go back to a $12 minimum wage, you're going to have a huge impact on not just teenagers in Ohio. I mean, that's not really questionable, but it's going to be a very hard policy for certain areas of the state that aren't as affluent as Columbus or Cincinnati.
What about the earned income tax credit, Michael Shields, or things like that? These are coming. These are policies. They're out there. What about that?
Sure. So the earned income tax credit is a good supplement. It helps to counter some of the regressivity that we have in our tax code right now. The lowest 20% of Ohio earners actually pay more as a share of their total income than the top 20%. So that's something that we need to address. But the fact of the matter is, we really need to see firms paying for the cost of the workers that they're employing. I mean, this is a basic operating cost. When we look at research on how the minimum wage affects employment, what we find is that it's inconclusive.
Right.
I think I heard, just as I was tuning in, Ray mentioned the CBO study. CBO did a study on this. What they found was that if we were to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, more than 27 million workers nationwide would get a raise. They found that on a net basis, it would inject about $44 billion in new earnings into the economy. These are earnings that go to people who work for a living, are supporting families, and are going to go out and spend that money in ways that drive the economy.
The kind of things like the durable goods kind of things, the washer and dryers, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And also non-durable goods, you know, just that higher quality and probably more non-durable goods as well and services. So all of these things, and particularly small businesses, really thrive when people in the communities where they're based are able to go out and participate in the consumer goods economy. Now, CBO, and I think Ray probably mentioned this, found an estimated 4.5% reduction in work hours for folks who would be affected by this increase up to $15 per hour. Now, some of that could, they characterize this as possibly resulting in job loss. Mm-hmm. It also could, I mean, technically what we're accounting for here is an hour's loss. So a lot of this is probably comprised of people getting sent home for the slow shift. But it's also true that the CBO study was an outlier study. There was a recent academic meta-analysis of 37 different studies on the minimum wage. The researchers found, and I can quote them, no support for the proposition that the minimum wage has had an important effect on U.S. employment. The research on this has not found a reduction in jobs, generally speaking, or a measurable reduction as a result of raising the minimum wage.
I want to turn to Thatch in Dublin. You're on the air, Thatch. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, guys. I appreciate it. This is a good conversation. Start the subject, get everybody's eyes and ears on it. But in my opinion, I'm a small business owner, and I have, you know, years ago even worked on, you know, a low job just to get my business off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, I mean, $8.50, that's not even, that doesn't even do justice for anybody. You know, I mean, alone with single family or with a child. I mean, even $10, $12, what? That can't even pay anything. You barely make rent.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if really going to make a difference, you got to start from the base, $15 an hour and off the minimum wage to even, you know, crack the market. I mean, for me, as a small business owner, if I'm looking to hire just to bring someone on board, I have to figure out my budget and how much can that person alone assist and generate income for me. You know, so I guess my comment is that $8.50, $10 is not going to do justice for anybody for the market.
And as a small business owner, Thatch, then what you're saying is, so what does that, so what if you could get away with paying people $8 an hour? Why does it matter to you how somebody survives on that or not?
Yeah, because, you know, for me, it's not so much the policy. Is as a small business owner, I want to bring someone on board that's productive, that I can train, that can stay with me, and I'm willing to pay good dollars, you know, for that, he or she, to be comfortable, to stay long-term with me, you know? So it's not, I don't lean on, you know, here's the minimum wage policy of Ohio. This is what, you know, you have to follow, and this is what I'm going to squeeze as much as I can, as low as possible. No, I look at differently. I look like how productive he or she can come on board,
mm-hmm.
and assist with the needs that I have, and how fast, how quick learner he or she is, and I'm willing to pay that amount of dollars. It's hard to find for me.
Hmm.
You know, in my line of work, I'm willing to pay someone $20 an hour to be able to do what I need to do, but it's just very difficult to find that.
Hmm.
So that's one thing that I have. Another thing is, you know, as a small business owner, you got to deal with health insurance and all that package stuff that come along with it.
Right.
So that's increased that the difficulty and the risk of that. Because then, you know, if you have, I have a small business of two or three employees, if I bring someone on board, they want to feel secure. They want to be with a company that they can, you know, sustain and expand with their family and with us. But that health insurance and 401k and all that thing, that opened up a whole new eyes for them to look for somewhere else. So that make it more difficult for me to bring someone on and say, hey, I'll pay you $18 or $20 an hour. At the same time, 1 foot in and 1 foot out is looking for bigger opportunity. You know, so, I mean,
okay.
But on the raw scale of just this basic low labor, you know, like Target, Whole Foods, all that, I mean,
mm-hmm.
people working there getting paid $10 an hour. I mean, I don't know. Seriously, I don't know how anybody can on that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just insane.
Thatch, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay.
Right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, take care. We'll continue our conversation. That was the viewpoint of a small business owner in Dublin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about minimum wage, and we're talking with two people who study it, coming from slightly different perspectives, or drastically different, depending on specifically what we're talking about, because there's a lot of moving parts in this conversation. Michael Shields studies minimum wage, overtime, and workers' comp issues for Policy Matters Ohio, and Ray Hederman is the executive director of the Economic Research Center. He studies basically the same things. He's vice president of policy at the Buckeye Institute. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the difference between the state's minimum wage and how it compares to a living wage. Is Ohio prepared to increase its minimum wage in January? More than 2 million Ohioans will be affected by the increase to $8.50 an hour, $8.70 an hour. Yeah. So with us is Ray Hederman. He's executive director of the Economic Research Center at the conservative think tank, the Buckeye Institute. Also, Michael Shields. He studies minimum wage, overtime, and workers' compensation issues for the liberal think tank Policy Matters Ohio. And Elizabeth Brown, she's serving her second term on the Columbus City Council, where she led the charge for a $15 per hour minimum wage for city workers. She's also executive director of the Ohio Women's Public Policy Network. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be here.
What were your calculations when you went for a $15 minimum wage increase for city workers? What do you think the impact's going to be?
Well, we actually did two things, the $15 an hour minimum for city workers, but we also instituted over a year ago a $15 an hour floor for any incentives that the city provides for job growth within the city.
What does that mean?
So that means if you're moving jobs to Columbus and or if you have your business here and you're trying to grow and you talk to the city about an income tax incentive to help that growth be achieved, we aren't going to provide an incentive for a $10 an hour job. It has to be at least $15 an hour.
So there's a couple things there then. What's it going to, how did you calculate what it's going to cost the city to pay for the minimum wage of $15 for city workers? And then how did you calculate what it might cost? This is kind of like the tree falling in the forest if nobody's there to hear it, proving a negative. But how did you calculate what it might cost the city?
Well, on the city workers piece, we actually, when we announced that this year, we were really nearly there anyway, just with natural growth in
and value of jobs. Yeah.
Yep. And for us, it makes sense as an employer because the cost to retrain a worker is much higher than the cost to retain that worker. So we really only had to adjust a few city employees and then deal with a little bit of wage compression, but it was not costly. On the city incentive side, you know, I really think it's pretty simple that when public tax dollars are on the line, you should have very high standards for what kind of jobs you're incentivizing. If we're incentivizing a company to create an $11 an hour job that forces a head of household or dual income household to then have an unstable housing situation, to have to rely on food assistance in order to get by, it really doesn't make sense for the city to put their tax dollars on the line to create that job. So we said it has to be at least $15 an hour as a floor.
And how did you come to the $15 an hour number?
Well, there's a lot out there
to
look into. And so a couple numbers that matter to me. The MIT Living Wage Calculator is an interesting one. And, you know, it puts a single person's living wage at closer to $11 an hour and a family, you know, with dependent children at closer to about $19 an hour in the Columbus metro area. So we looked for something that was in between that. There's also something called the housing wage that has emerged now. Maybe it's been around for a while, but I've newly keyed in onto it. And it is, it calculates what in any given area it would cost a family to afford a two-bedroom rental home. So in Ohio right now, that is $15.73. That's what it would cost a family on average across Ohio.
To use the right proportion of their income for housing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, according to HUD guidelines. Yeah.
Michael Shields, is this a sort of policy? This is kind of a push policy. This is pushing when you require companies, if they want incentives, to provide a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Yes.
And what do we know about the effectiveness of it?
Well, I haven't actually looked at in detail about the Columbus measure. I know it was a great policy and also for public workers as well. I haven't done an impact analysis on that. I've looked at, what would happen if we passed a statewide $15 minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
I think you mentioned that figure would benefit an estimated 2 million Ohio workers. But I haven't had a chance to really look at the Columbus outcome.
Ray Hederman, what do we know about these kind of push policies? That's the way I'm visualizing it, at least.
Yeah. Well, I'm not such a big fan of using tax dollars, you know, to encourage businesses
anyway.
Right.
Yeah, that's another topic for another way.
But I think, you know, one of the things that the commonalities, you know, that Elizabeth mentioned, and in our small business owner is when you're paying, you know, $15, you know, you're calling it a flight to quality. And what you're doing is you're basically making your jobs more available to your more highly educated workers. And so what you're doing is trying to get the best and brightest that want to work for that wage. And we've seen studies of that, that when the minimum wage goes up, less popular businesses, lower rated restaurants go out of business. And the idea is because you're paying people more, you want to invest in these workers and keep them trained. And again, you know, the problem, though, is you're setting a floor so high that some of these people need to be at least worth $15 an hour. So how are companies going to be able to invest in resources for people that are just starting out in their career? And again, this is why a lot of minimum wage studies show that teenagers are the big losers in the minimum wage fight because they don't have those skills.
But what do we know about policies like this and whether or not the city loses or gains when you hold the bar higher?
Sure. I think not so much, I think, when you're holding the bar higher. I think we have a fair amount of research that says a lot of these city inducements don't pay for themselves.
Well,
Like Michael, I haven't studied the idea that that you're trying to attract basically white collar workers.
And Elizabeth Brown, what do you know about it? Why did you go that route?
I don't know that many people would call $15 an hour a white collar job. I mean, I think we're trying to set a baseline for ensuring that these jobs that are created actually pay a wage where families can afford their homes. And, you know, you mentioned that teenagers are possibly the biggest losers. I've not seen that study, but teenagers aren't typically minimum wage workers. Two-thirds of minimum wage workers are women, and 41% of women are sole or primary breadwinners for their families. So if you raise wages in my city or in our state, you are directly helping women and families support their families.
Right. But about 47% of minimum wage workers are under 25, about a third are teenagers. And so, you know, there's a big concern that you're leaving a lot of the labor market behind. And
Michael Shields?
I want to weigh in on that. So when you say minimum wage workers, now the fact of the matter is most workers who would be affected by a higher minimum wage are not at the minimum wage. Now, I looked at who would be impacted if we were to raise the Ohio minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2023. Accounting for inflation, that's worth about $13.05 in today's terms. People who are earning less than that or slightly more and would therefore probably also get a bump, 82% of those folks are age 21 plus, 86% of those folks are already out of high school, and close to half have had some form of college. They may be college students working their way through. Of course, we know that tuition rates have exploded. The state's not investing as much in supporting our public universities. But, you know, back to Elizabeth's point, the folks who benefit from this are overwhelmingly adults. Many of them are raising families. I found more than 500,000 parents would benefit from a policy like this. We know that 42% of women would benefit. We know that among black workers, just over half, about 54%, would also benefit. And over the last four decades, the wage gap between black and white workers has more than doubled. Black workers today are earning $2 an hour less than they were. This is something that we need to support adults. This is something that we need to support equity.
Let's see. Ernie and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Ernie.
This is a fascinating discussion. I'm always interested when I hear people talk about the minimum wage and the hundreds of rationalizations why it shouldn't be raised. In the meanwhile, the federal government, state governments, counties, cities, fascinated with cutting taxes on corporations. Our president has even bragged that he didn't pay any taxes for a couple of years. I think last year there was one of our major multi-billion-dollar corporations paid no taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no idea what the minimum wage should be, but it's endlessly fascinating how we can find all these rationalizations not to pay people a living wage while we're so very, very much concerned about corporate profits. Thank you.
Thanks, Ernie. Ray Hederman?
I know
with you, it's never an either-or proposition. It's not that you're necessarily for corporate tax breaks either.
So I think Elizabeth mentioned, you know, kind of the highlights right now that we have an extremely fast growing economy. Mm-hmm. And I think that the evidence is clear, corporate taxes are anti-growth. And so we've actually been able to increase the economy so fast that, as Elizabeth mentioned, only a few workers in the city of Columbus were even affected by the $15 threshold and more in the wage compression.
More of a exactly. Message than anything
and
else.
So what we're seeing right now is that because of a lot of the tax policies, we're seeing a red hot economy nationwide that is offering higher wage growth, more job opportunities, bonuses for workers. And this is what you expect, this type of wage growth, when you have an economy this fast.
Yeah. Elizabeth Brown?
Sorry, I didn't mean to confuse my numbers there. The couple workers who benefited from the $15 an hour increase, those couple workers, that was from our city employees,
right.
the folks employed by the city of Columbus, right? So they are not indicative overall of the entire Columbus economy. And actually what we're seeing that's really hard to get our arms around and gets me up every morning and keeps me up every night is the fact that while the economy has done quite well as we've fought our way out of this recession, it has not been equally spread to families. So, you talk to the folks at the Community Shelter Board who are managing our homeless system, and we are seeing more and more families struggle with homelessness. There's overcrowding in our family homeless shelters. People are having a hard time affording housing. Our food banks continue to have long lines, and this is in the middle of, as you say, a red-hot economy. That's exactly the problem, that the economy overall, these measures, these sort of macro numbers that we look at to see growth in the economy are not actually working for lower and middle-income families.
So I would push back a little bit that I think a lot of the data that has come out that looks at the income of middle-income families finds that compensation, health insurance, wages have increased pretty robustly. The problem I think that we've seen is that the recovery was so poor coming out of the Great Recession that a lot of people feel like, we're still playing catch up. And so you're absolutely right that more needs to be done. But I think the last 2 years, you have seen strong increases in wage and compensation, according to the best data that we have. That's not to say that there's not a huge problem with homelessness and everything, especially in some urban areas. But the good news is, I think that by the way we measure things, middle class families in the country are doing a lot better.
Well, when we see income tax growth in the city of Columbus, and I spend a lot of time with our city auditor, I'm the chair of our finance committee, actually, we are really concerned about middle income growth in the city of Columbus. And we are seeing more jobs added in that sort of lower income sector. And that concerns us in terms of a city budget perspective. We need to do more to lift wages, not only because it's better for families, better for our housing and our food system and our overall economy. But also because it's simply better for our city budget.
I want to squeeze one more person in here. Bryce in Urbana, you're on the air. You're a small business owner.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Mm-hmm. On a personal note, I am for increasing minimum wage absolutely slowly over time. That's great. On a business perspective, though, I have a retail shop, and it's tough enough to compete with online sales. If we increase wages too quickly, there's no way I could compete with them. I mean, I don't take that much income for myself. I live in a $50,000 house. I'm not, driving a Bentley off my community.
Hmm. So, yeah, but do you think that it's small businesses like yours that are really targeted by these kind of policies?
No, I don't feel targeted. I just squeezing pennies just gets tougher and tougher all the time. Hmm.
So I'd like to weigh in if I can.
Yeah, sure.
So we know from the overwhelming body of research on this that low-wage workers are already covering enough. They're already producing enough revenue to cover the cost of a living wage. Now, we've seen that. We know that because when wages go up and businesses retain their workers, we know they're meeting the cost. So that's the general story, right? But one of the things that we found, and we did a case study about a year ago with the Greater Cleveland Food Bank. They said, we want to work to help people to attain sufficiency, and we realize that in order to do that, they have to be able to earn a high enough living to cover the basics, right? So in order to do that, they said, you know, we had to make some changes to the way that we were to our operating procedures. And so they did some things like they brought in some more revenue and streamlined their pay scale. They also wanted to be sure to raise wages for people who were earning a little bit more. They bumped their wage to 14. But they also found that they were able to retain workers. They didn't have to retrain folks. They were able to keep workers longer. And also, just as they were investing in workers, those workers became more effective. You know, poverty transforms 1,000 little problems into crises. I need to stop for gas becomes I can't afford to get to work. And to think that poverty doesn't hurt the way we're able to perform at work, you know, that's not realistic. So businesses that address that for their workers are the ones who are really going to be able to thrive. Some of it is, you know, pivoting a little bit on your strategy, but raising the minimum wage is a level playing field for all businesses. You know, you then don't have others paying less than a living wage and undercutting on prices in that sense. Solving this problem for solving the problem of poverty is going to help businesses to thrive.
Michael Shields of Policy Matters Ohio, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ray Hederman of the Buckeye Institute, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
And Elizabeth Brown of the Columbus City Council, she led the charge for the $15 per hour minimum wage for city workers. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.